This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Hi, I'm Ben Stiller. Welcome to the show. I guess you're wondering who I am and what the show's about. Well, I don't know. I've never really had a show before. It's my first time. It's a comedy thing. You know, we do lots of little funny films, hopefully funny. I don't know, we got to start it up, so I don't know. Anybody have any ideas on how to start the show? Anybody have anything?
You can see what Ben Stiller did come up with when his new comedy show premieres this Sunday night at 7:30 on Fox. In the meantime, here's a little preview. Stiller's sketches lampoon MTV, movies, television, commercials, and confessional video journals. Stiller plays a young but already pretentious Bono in the rockumentary U2 The Early Years. There's a parody of those sleek, sexy, and absurdly arty ads for jeans and perfumes, but this ad is for Wilson Garden Hoses, available at your local hardware store. And Stiller does a remake of Cape Fear, only this is Cape Munster, in which an angry Eddie Munster seeks revenge against the TV executive who canceled his show and ruined his career. Stiller, of course, stars as Eddie Munster. Comedy was the family business when Stiller was growing up. His parents are the comedy team of Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira. I asked Ben Stiller if he watches a lot of TV.
I watch way too much television, Terry. I did when I was a kid, and so now this is just a way for me to try to make a living with no formal training in any other field.
Right.
So I'm just kind of, it's definitely been an influence on me, so... I think there are a lot of things to make fun of on television. So.
Yeah, I want to get to one of the visual details in the Bono documentary. You have him, this is the earlier, so you have him doing a breakfast cereal commercial.
Right, a commercial for Lucky Clover cereal.
Yeah, and you're combining two completely different languages in the commercial. Because you have like the upbeat breakfast cereal kind of language, and since it's Lucky Clovers, there's a little dancing leprechaun. But of course, because it's Bono, there's all this like MTV rock video stuff happening too. So there's a scene where he's eating a cereal, and there's a buffalo surrealistically walking across the frame, and a beautiful woman walking across the frame. So you've really gotten the language down.
Well, you know, videos, it's just like there's no rules in these videos, and there's so many pretentious videos out there that...
Yes, thank you.
You know,
so true.
So why not? You know, what we did was, with that one, with the Lucky Clovers, you two doing the Lucky Clovers commercials, we took... There are three different videos, which I think is funny also, that U2 did three videos for their song One.
Mm-hmm.
As if, you know, one wasn't enough, they had to do three pretentious videos. I mean, I like U2, too. I know that sounds like I'm contradicting myself, but I really love their music. But there's one where it's just a buffalo. Did you ever see that? There's just buffaloes running around in a field. Like buffaloes in slow motion, buffaloes, paintings of buffaloes, every different buffalo, permutation you can imagine. So we took that one. Then there's one where they're sitting in that black and white one in Berlin where they're in drag, which we also did. And then there's the one where he's just at the at this table singing to the camera. So we kind of combined all of those and then tried to put a little bit of a twist on it by just, throwing in the idea that they're doing a commercial for cereal, which I don't think you'd ever see you two doing. So
in one of the sketches, you play a Hollywood agent who's trying to get his clients, like Roseanne and Tom Arnold and Gary Shandling, to make disease movies.
Let's get serious. Come on, you guys are too good for comedy. I mean, let's do a disease, all right? Tom, you get sick. Rosie, you come and take care of him. Rosie, you get sick. Tom takes care of you. I mean, I don't care. It works both ways. You both get sick, you die, you fall in love, whatever, right? You're the creative ones. You can figure it out.
We're beginning to feel like maybe you're not the right agent for us.
What? This is a bit, right? Doing a thing? I love it. All right, keep going. Come on.
You haven't done crap for us.
All right. Where's the punch? Oh, come on, Rosie. Come on. What do you want? You're number one. Where else can we go?
The show was number one when we hired you.
Whew. This weight loss thing is really playing with your heads, guys. I mean, really, is this the Slim Shake talking? Because if it is, let's go across the street, let's get a cheeseburger, fries, fried chicken, load it up and eat it, because nothing is worth this, all right? Let's face it, the diet is killing your careers. Fat is funny. You go back in time, Greeks, Romans, in the tub, rub-a-dub-lub, three men having fun.
Is this based on an agent that you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, he's my my ex-agent.
Oh, really?
In 5 years I had him. And, he wasn't a bad guy. He actually worked really, really hard for me. And this is how I pay him back.
So is this why he's your ex-agent?
Yeah, it is. Gosh, he threatened to sue me, actually. He made me, if I made the name too similar to his. But yeah, you know, all agents have a certain amount of, I don't know what it is, like a kind of a bull factor, I guess. They're always kind of blowing smoke at you, and it's a really strange profession. You know, they're just, it's all hype and keeping actors, you know, thinking that, you know, you're finding work for them when you're really just, you know, kind of going out there and trying to drum up work for them. It's just like you're, you know, they're all, and then they'll kind of change with the wind on you a lot of the time too. You know, if you say something, you know, you say, oh, I, you know, would you like a movie will come out and they'll like be, oh, it was great, and then, you know, then it won't do well, and they'll be, yeah, you know, well, it was all right, it wasn't really, you know, you don't want to do that. It's just, they'll be very, they'll just kind of, they talk in circles, and that's, this guy kind of just talks around and around. He'll be pitching horrible ideas. You know, you should do a sitcom. You know, you could be doing a thing with Bea Arthur. You know, it's you and her, and she's, you know, she lives next door, and she's gruff, and you're, you know, you're crazy, but you, you know, you like her, but you don't like her, and then all of a sudden something happens. You teach each other how to love. It's beautiful, you know? And, you know, he just kind of, they always deal in concepts, you know?
You know? Did you ever try to go along with him on one of these ideas and really get your hopes up that you were going to do this sitcom with Bea Arthur and teach each other how to love?
Yeah, for 5 years. I was... He's calling me up with these ideas. And then, like, then when I started directing, he would, like, call me up with these just things that he'd never, totally untrue. He'd be like, you want to direct, he goes, you want to direct Ice Cube's new video? I go, I don't know. You know, I'm like a Jewish kid from New York. You really think he wants me? He goes, yeah. He goes, yeah, well, I'll talk to him about it. You know, the only thing is you got to go to Compton every day, but you could deal with that, right? You know, meanwhile, he's never even, you know, he never even talked to him. He'd always be throwing out stuff like that. So you know, you learn to kind of not take it too seriously after a while and just kind of take notes so that you can use it down the line on your own show, hopefully, you know?
Is
you
it,
can do something productive with it.
Is it hard to break up with an agent? Did you feel very guilty about it?
Yeah, it is, actually. It's really hard because you do develop a close relationship because, you know, an agent has your career in his hands and actors are really insecure and you're kind of always, you know, he's your link to the outside world. He's going to be taking all the offers or auditions that you go on. He gets the feedback and he tells you and he has to kind of sift it through to you without, you know, kind of dealing with that fragile ego that actors have. So he's your link. And if, you know, you develop a bond with him in some way because it's kind of like this codependent relationship that develops, you know, where you really need to, you need the approval and, So when it finally comes time to change, it's like breaking up with a girlfriend or something like that because, you know, there are always aspects that you really like about the person, but you also know that you have to move on. So it's not easy. It's not fun to do, especially when you know it's been a few years and you know you've been working with someone for a long time. There's loyalty questions, all that stuff.
When you told him you were going to find somebody else, did he try to convince you to stay?
Oh, of course. He just went into a whole thing. He said, you're going to hate him. I told, you know, he knew. He goes, all right, you'll be back. He goes, you'll be back. Look, you know, good luck. And actually, my first agent who I left, yeah, that's what he said to me. He said, you'll be back in a year. And that was like 7 years ago. And then I went to the next guy and he said, you know, good luck, and, you know, I really think you're making a mistake, this guy. And they started telling me stories about the guy. You know, I mean, but you know what? He was all out of really wanting to, I think he really felt like he wanted, you know, he believed in me and he wanted me to give him another shot. But, you know, it was just kind of, you know, you have a sense about that in when you're, you know, in what you do when it's time to to make a decision like that. And it's not easy. No.
It sounds like there should be special agents whose job it is to represent you when you're breaking up with your own agent. So, because this is one place where you've got nobody to represent you.
That's what your manager is for.
Oh, I see.
They deal with your agent.
Okay.
They tell you.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ben Stiller, and he has a new comedy series that premieres this Sunday at 7:30 on Fox. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Ben Stiller is with me, and his new program starts this Sunday night on Fox. Your parents are Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira.
No, that's not them. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, yes.
That's another Stiller.
Right.
No, I'm sorry.
So were there lots of showbiz people around the house when you were growing up?
Yeah, there were. It was kind of, it was a crazy, crazy household. It was Rodney Dangerfield would come over for Thanksgiving. Andy Kaufman came over. And have chocolate milk at Passover. Weird things.
When you were growing up, were your parents in the kitchen working out routines?
And yeah, they were in the living room, actually. They were they had an office in the living room, and they would close the door, and we would hear them working on their routines. My dad had this reel-to-reel tape recorder, I used to love gadgets and stuff, and I just thought he had this great reel-to-reel tape recorder, and I was about 7 or 8, and all I could think of was, when my parents die, I'm going to inherit this tape recorder. That was all I thought. That was the coolest thing in the world.
What were you going to do with it?
I was going to make my own tapes and, you know, probably, like, record soundtracks to movies, you know, because I made Super 8 films, and I was... So they would go in there and they would work on their stuff, and you know, they'd take us on the road with them when they would go and do Las Vegas or go out to California.
Oh boy, share with us a memory of being on the road with your parents when they were doing Las Vegas.
Okay, let's see. Well, there was we spent a lot of time in motels, and I remember my folks they worked with people like Lola Falana, and. You know, they were, you know, they had their brushes with like Frank Sinatra and people like that. I never met him, but there was also a lot of time hanging out on sets. Like my parents took us on the Partridge Family set in California, and
now was that a thrill, or did you think, oh, this is what an absurd show?
No. I was totally into it. You know, I mean, I thought this is you know, so cool. Danny Bonaducci was like kind of flirting with my sister, which is funny now in retrospect. But my parents did The Courtship of Eddie's Father. Do you remember that show?
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember Brandon Cruz, who was Eddie on the show, came up to me, and we were about the same age, and I had this candy bar, and he just knocked it out of my hand, like in this kind of show of his power on the set to kind of just establish who was the boss on the set. And then he walked away from me. I'll never forget that one.
How did you feel?
I felt small. I was just kind of shocked, I think. You know, I didn't know, you know, who this guy was. But, you know, that was kind of tempered by Bobby Brady waving to me from the stagecoach when they were doing the Grand Canyon episode. You know, so, I mean, and that's real. I mean, that's true. So,
making you feel like you were really somebody.
That's right. It kind of brought me back up again.
So did your friends' parents work in show business, too?
I had some... friends whose parents were in show business, but you know, we grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and it was it's not like a typical environment. It's not like suburbia, and it's not middle America at all. And I think, you know, I never really knew what a normal environment was like. I thought when I finally kind of got out of New York a little bit, I was kind of fascinated by the suburbs. I went to do a movie like 5 years ago in Cincinnati, and I just thought it was the most amazing place in the world, because it was like, here are all these like houses that I'd seen in commercials, you know. I met this girl. I started going out with this girl there, and I think I was more into her family, which, you know, they had a dog, and she had a little brother, and her father was like Mr. All American. He'd been in the Air Force, and he played football, and they, you know, it just was like, this is, wow, this is America. And I felt like kind of this like little spy, and you know, kind of seeing what the rest of the country lived like. So it was really an interesting experience for me. So, but it kind of wore off after a while.
When there were showbiz people around the house, would you feel comfortable talking with them?
It was. I guess so. I mean, I didn't really consider them showbiz people, though. You know, it was more like they were just my parents' friends. You know, those were the people who they hung out with, and who were, and we were around the theater a lot, and we were, you know, that was just kind of our life. So it wasn't like, you know, I remember when my dad did this play Hurly Burly a few years back. I was about, I think, 17 or 18, and that had like this cast like William Hurt and Sigourney Weaver and Judith Ivey, and just like, you know, Ron Silver, Harvey Keitel. It was just this great cast. And I remember hanging out, you know, at that point we were older, but these were like people who were more from like, you know, movie stars from my generation, you know, who my dad was working with.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very kind of exciting for my sister and I at that point, because we were kind of young and we were just getting into the business, and you know, to be hanging out with William Hurt. I was like, you know, a big Altered States fan, and my dad like invited him up to our country house, and he went fishing with him. So I'm like fishing with William Hurt, and he's really, you are unique. And he's telling me that.
He's telling you.
He was telling me. He was telling me. Yeah, he was really intense. He would just get really intense. The fish aren't biting. And he just got very intense about whatever he talked about. And so I was just freaking out. I was having a great time. You know, this is so cool.
What were your early stabs of becoming a performer?
I always wanted to make films. That's what I always wanted to do since I was like, you know, 11 or 12. And
yeah, you said you had a Super 8. What did you do with that?
Oh, I made all sorts of mainly murder movies.
Uh-huh.
They called it Murder, I think was the first one. Murder in the Park. We did Airport 75, I remember, where I turned the foyer into an airplane, and then I took a model of a 747 and stuck some matches in the cockpit and lit them, and then put the airplane up to the window and filmed it. And then I took the same airplane and I had this diorama that I built for my train set with mountains, and I crashed the airplane into the side of the mountain and burned my whole train set. So I do those, make a lot of those films. I always like experimenting with special effects and stuff like that. And then, as I got older, I thought, okay, I'm going to be an actor first and then go into filmmaking that way. For some reason, I guess I just wanted to perform also. So, and I thought I was going to be a serious actor for a long time. Like when I was about 18, I thought, you know, cause I grew up with comedy, I was kind of rebelling against the whole thing. And, so I said, I'm going to be serious, you know, and that, what happened was somehow it came out. The other stuff started to come out. I started to, I got a job doing this play, House of Blue Leaves. And while we were doing that, it was a long run. We ran at Lincoln Center for about a year. And then we moved theaters in the middle. But it was a long run. Everybody got to know each other very well. And I had this home video camera. So I started making little documentaries and behind the scenes shorts about, you know, the cast. And we did this one about John Mahoney, who you said you had on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like, we called it Portrait of the Artist as an Old Man. And it was just kind of this seedy look at his backstage life, where he was kind of this alcoholic, womanizing lech. And we did interviews with everybody in the cast, like Danny Aiello and Julie Haggerty and Susie Kurtz, everybody talking about how John was, you know, he's just like the, you know, this horrible guy. And then, I mean, I even got John to lay down in the gutter with a wino bag underneath his poster for saying Tony Award winning House of Blue Leaves. It's the funniest shot, and he was great. And so that to me, and then I showed that at a New Year's Eve party for the whole cast, and everybody laughed, and it was, of course, it was a really friendly you know, audience. But that kind of made me think, hey, I could do this. This could be really fun. And then from that, I started making some more short films, and I did a takeoff on The Color of Money. That was about bowling instead of pool when that movie came out. And I sold that to Saturday Night Live, and that was really encouraging. And then that just kind of started the ball rolling, you know, I just said, okay, I'm going to go for it and, you know, do this type of thing.
I like what you said before, that originally you were rebelling against comedy and you were going to be serious.
Yeah.
It's a kind of interesting notion, rebelling against comedy.
I know. Well, that's all I had to rebel against.
Yeah, really.
My parents, you know, they didn't beat me. They were you know, very nice and supportive. And, you know, that's kind of tough to deal with also. It's like, what do you rebel against? So I wanted to be really serious.
Did you ever do stand-up?
No. But we do takeoffs on stand-up comedians on the show a lot. Like we do on the first show, we do this Yakov Smirnov thing.
Oh, yeah. What happens to Yakov Smirnov after the end of the Cold War?
Right, the idea is that he has no act left, so he's just doing a lot of jokes about former Soviet Union. In former Soviet Union, we used to have no freedom. Now we have freedom. What a sovereignty of independent nations. I love it. And he's just bombing, just going nowhere. So he starts, like, grasping for straws. In Soviet Union, we used to have KGB. Now we have KFC, Kentucky Fried Chicken. that Yakov laugh. And then he really starts grasping for straws. And he's like, did I ever tell you I am part Chinese? Which is still communist country. In China, you have food. An hour later, you want freedom. And then just, it turns into this nightmare. He starts going, I wish communism would come back. I am cold. I am frightened. What will New World Order bring for Yakov?
You think you'll be hearing from him?
I don't know. I'm sure I'll be hearing from his lawyers. It's unnecessarily cruel. But I got to tell you, I saw him driving down Sunset Boulevard in a red Ferrari with the license plate X red, and he was just like smiling on his car phone. I thought, okay, forget it. No, I just can't. All right, anyway, I won't say anything more.
So now that you have a TV show, when you watch TV, do you see it differently? You know, because as someone who's watched TV a lot all of his life?
Yeah, you know what? Honestly, what I see is just it's really tough to put out a half hour of comedy that you believe in, you know, you think is really funny every week. You have so much to film in such a short amount of time. You're always working against the clock and budget constraints. So it's not easy. You know what's tough, too, is getting on the air. I don't think people understand how tough it is to actually get to a show that's picked up for a series. Like, you know, we developed this show for a couple of years, and, you know, the networks are just, you know, they make a lot of decisions based on demographics and focus groups and all these, you know, factors. And there are so many pilots that are made. And, you know, a lot of them stink, and, you know, but there are a lot of good ones, too, I think, that get made and then don't get picked up. So I feel really lucky that we even got to this point where we're on the air.
Are you a survivor of focus groups?
Oh, I went to the focus group for my own show. It was like the war. It was like the surreal high school nightmare to stand behind a two-way mirror and watch people talk about you for 4 hours and criticize you. And all they do is
and
ask...
And who are they?
Who are they? Yeah, well, who are they? That's, you know what? It was the strangest amalgam of, like, you know who they are? They're people. They go to a mall and they say, do you like Herman's Head? And if they say yes, and they say, do you want $35 and a free sandwich? And then that's the criteria. That's it. And then they come up to the room, and then they judge, you know, and they pass judgment, which the network takes very seriously on what you've been working on, you know, you've been, you know, putting your whole life into it. And then these people come in, and you're in the middle, it's in the middle of, you know, your big piece on the show, and they're like going over to try to get another carrot stick, you know, and you think, no, just watch it. And they you know, and they're all different funny types in there, and just they all claim that they don't know anything about, you know, about show business. So they're all like, well, you know, one guy's a mechanic, but then he's saying, you know, I think the protagonist was rather weak in the first act. And they have all got screenplays, you know, because they do it. They did ours outside of Los Angeles, so it was, it was pretty wild to sit through that. After that, I thought I could, you know, I feel like I could deal with anything.
Ben Stiller, good luck with your show.
Thanks, Terry.
And thanks a lot for talking with us.
All right, it was fun. Thanks.
The Ben Stiller Show premieres this Sunday night at 7:30 on Fox. Here's Stiller from his parody, U2 The Early Years. The band is playing a bar mitzvah. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.